I'm Peter Lipman, Chair of Transition Network. Thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
What do you think that politicians could do to more fully support the Transition Town movement?
I sort of feel like I should ask you that question. I think one of the things that I wanted to, one of the reasons I wanted to come here was to, I've seen Rob's book, but I wanted to find out more about what people themselves here were saying about the Transition Towns movement, about what it had done for them, and about what government could do to get involved. I suppose the message I take out from having talked to people is the single most important message is the way it brings people together in a community. And in a way, it goes beyond issues of climate change and peak oil to issues of getting to know people in your local area. I think opinion is a bit divided about what government can do, but I'm, in a way, quite heartened that people do want government to play a role and to provide support. I think the last thing government must do is sort of strangle the movement. So that's why I was actually a bit sort of wary about whether people would want government to be involved. But I mean, in a way, maybe I should ask you what you think government should be doing.
Well, one thing that's been suggested is that just as in the Scottish Government has set up its Community Climate Challenge Fund, £23 million, I think, to support community-based initiatives, could that be done in England?
Well, I'm very interested in looking at that because someone just suggested it to me on the table. I think there are also people specifically helping work on transition towns, and I'm very happy to look at that. As I say, I mean, in a way, I think what's interesting about the movement is it's obviously grown up without government, and so you don't want government to be heavy-handed in a way about it. But I would be I'd be very happy to talk about that and talk about. And you should come and meet me and talk to me about how government can be supportive of this. I'm not sure I've got £23 million in my back pocket. But
well, it would be £150 million. If you
right, I certainly don't have Scotland that in my back pocket. But I mean, I'd like to talk to you about how we can be supportive.
Well, one other thing I think that generally comes across from people in transition is that there's a worry that there's a gap between government words, which are proportionate to the scale of the challenge, and government action. And really, you could say what government could best do is get its words to match its actions. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, we should talk about the specific issues involved, and I can imagine what they are. I mean,
take the third runway.
Sure. I mean, look, in a way, we're in a sort of different business, slightly. We're in a similar business, but we're in a different business. My business, I was saying to the folks upstairs, is I think to myself, climate change is an absolutely huge challenge, and we probably only have 10 or 15 people who are really committed to it already. So we've got a massively long way to go to convince all those extra people that is the right thing to do. And in a way, I suppose what's interesting about transition towns is it's about saying, well, that climate change is a challenge, but we think there's a big, deeper message here. Now, I think what's daunting about that for me is that feels like a bigger job of persuasion than simply persuading people about climate change. On the issue of Heathrow and aviation, I think that, and this is a slight difference between us, I think that we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years, people, for example, being able to travel to places that their parents would never have dreamed of. Now, as someone who's interested in the politics of persuasion, I don't think I can say to people, we've got to turn the clock back to 30 years ago. But I do think we can no longer say, let's have unlimited growth in aviation, which is why we imposed a whole set of conditions around the third runway. Indeed, we're the only country in the world to say we're going to actually get our aviation emissions back by 2050 to current levels. But look, I appreciate there's more to do in a whole range of areas.
Can I just pick up, you referred to unlimited growth.
Yeah.
But it seems to be a basic principle of government that unlimited economic growth is a good thing. And I think it's pretty core to the transition movement that we would say there's a flat contradiction between economic growth and actually tackling climate change meaningfully. What do you think?
See, I don't agree with that, because I think that we've got to have a different model of economic growth, low-carbon economic growth. But the thing I think about, if I think about my own constituency, or if I think about China or India, is that economic growth is what lifts people out of poverty and raises people's living standards.
We're not in China or India, Ed. We're in a country that's had economic growth.
I know, but there are still lots of people in poverty in this country, and there are lots of my constituents. We've seen a period in the last year and a half where we've had no economic growth, and we've seen lots of people lose their jobs. Now, you know, I don't think that's been a very good thing for Britain, to be honest. So I agree with you, you've got to have a different model of economic growth, but I'm not sure that a message of no growth is either going to persuade people or is actually the right thing. Because, as I say, if you think about the last 40 years, part of your argument, I think, and I have some sympathy with this argument, is that we've seen some bad things in the last 40 years, communities growing further apart, more atomized society. I agree with that. But I also think that the rises in living standards in the last 40 years have massively improved the quality of life of people in my constituency. Central heating that they would never have had before, you know, and all kinds of other things. Now, you know, so I suppose I at least want to say there's a dilemma here.
I think there is a big dilemma, but the dilemma that really concerns me is the intergenerational one, is the fact that if we say we have to have economic growth now to lift everyone up out of poverty, what does that mean about everyone's children, children's 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 children? You know, are we going to trash the whole world now?
No, we mustn't
so
do that.
Future generations mustn't do that. Have nothing.
But what do you, if I said to you, well, we can have economic growth, we need to do it with a completely different model where we don't have carbon coming out of our energy sector because we have renewables and clean fossil fuels and indeed nuclear, let's not get onto that, that we have a completely different model of how we heat our homes and the insulation that we have in our homes and a completely different model of transport involving electric cars and a whole range of other things. Now that's not no economic growth, that's just a different model of economic growth, of low carbon growth and a low carbon society.
I think that's an interesting picture which fulfills a deep cultural story that there is this progress and technological fix which is always going to be possible somehow. And I think all the evidence literally points in the opposite direction. So I think we need to have that discussion, actually. We really do. And I think, Rob, you've got a few things you wanted to say.
I've asked all my questions. Well, I suppose it was a question that I asked you the other day, really, which was about, you know, when the International Energy Agency and various organisations are saying that actually we're nearing a plateau in world oil production, or that peak oil is a very serious issue, and several other governments around the world have commissioned studies to look at the impacts of peak oil and its implications, why the UK government still takes a position that it's not something we even need to think about until 2030.
Well, I don't think it's a thing we don't need to think about. I think, though, that what's interesting, if you think about the history of the debate of peak oil, as I understand it, is climate change, I think, makes the debate about peak oil a bit of a second-order debate, because we have to start making the transition anyway. And we have to start making the transition to low-carbon forms of energy in any case. Whether you think the peak oil is in 2020, 2030, or 2040, now I think we're in a transition, we're a transition economy, and oil and gas and other things are part of the transition. But I'm absolutely convinced, I don't need to have the debate about peak oil and the precise date of peak oil. The truth is, it is difficult to pin down, to know that we've got to start making the transition as quickly as possible.
Ed, we're going in the opposite direction because, I would argue, because we're at or close to peak oil, that's why the Canadians are using the tar sands to generate artificial oil. And that's incredibly climate change disastrous, really, because it's got a very high carbon footprint. So they're basically using clean water and natural gas, which is a relatively clean fossil fuel, to steam heat the tar sands to extract an equivalent to oil, because oil is such a dense and useful form of concentrated energy.
What's your answer to that? You see, I think our answer is probably to that the same, which is, well, let's make the transition to lower carbon forms of energy as quickly as possible.
I think the first answer is the transition to a different way of living, and after that, at the same time, transition to different forms of energy, lower carbon forms of energy. But unless we change the way we live, then I think we're always going to be actually going in the opposite direction. At the moment, parts per million are going up. They're not even stabilising. So, you know, atmospheric concentrations are rising. So the transition that we're having at the moment is from pretty bloody dangerous to catastrophic.
You see, I suppose you're less, in a way I'm less optimistic than you are, but in a way you're less optimistic than I am. I'm optimistic. You're optimistic that you can persuade people to adopt a model of a sort of no growth, I don't want to caricature it, but a sort of no growth model of society. I'm not sure that you could, I'm pretty convinced you couldn't persuade people of that, and I'm not convinced it's actually the right thing to do. But I'm more optimistic than you are that if government makes the right decisions, and you don't think we've made the right decision in every area, let's put it that way, but if government makes the right decisions, you can actually transition quickly to a different form of economic growth. And actually look at what President Obama is doing in the United States. United States. I mean, I think that is a good reason to be hopeful. If you think about what the Chinese are thinking, they're thinking, actually, we've got to face real challenges around climate change. We need to change the way we do things. But I suppose the package of let's transition out of high carbon growth to low carbon growth is a pretty big ask, in my view. I think even if you were right, and I don't actually agree with you, but even if you were right about your model of society, I don't believe you're going to persuade people of
that. Okay, final question then in that case. And the thing that gives me hope, and I feel immensely hopeful and excited, is what's going on in that hall, what's going on all around the world. The growth of a model which fundamentally questions, it's not just about climate change, it's not just about people, it's about economic growth. And actually, the people in that room are there partly because they question the idea of ongoing economic growth in a finite physical world. So I'd like to bounce it back to you. You're saying that you don't think that would convince people. Why then is the transition movement such a rapidly growing movement?
That's because you have got inspiring leadership, the transition movement.
That's flat.
No, look, I think it's very exciting too, the people I've talked to in there. And in a way, look, why am I here? If I disagreed with everything you thought, I wouldn't be here. I'm here because it is a very interesting idea. It's obviously generating huge enthusiasm in particular areas. And in a way, look, the more you can persuade people to adopt a different way of life, fine. I suppose I'm just saying that at the overall level, when I think about my constituency or other people I meet in Britain, I just think saying to people it's a sort of no-growth proposition, I think it ignores the benefits that people have got from economic growth. And I suppose, as a sort of somewhat interested in people's welfare, I sort of can't ignore that. Now, of course, climate change is a massive threat to people's welfare, and we've got to persuade people of that. But I just sort of think that somehow not accepting the changes in people's welfare that we've seen as a result of economic growth, I think it ignores a big part of the way people see their own lives.
Well, I
think
Dominic, absolutely. I want to carry on.
We will carry on the conversation.
What do you think? Let me ask you this question. Yeah. What do you think government? Oh, you think the 150 million? But apart from the 150 million, I mean, how do you see the relationship between what government does and the Transition Towns movement, local government and central government?
I think the most important thing that government could do is to move towards real local democracy. So, for example, adopting the models from Puerto Alegre and other places of local participatory budget setting would be absolutely fascinating, because if you think of an active transition town which is wanting to do things in all sectors of life, food, transport, energy, if they had some control over local budgets, then they could really say, well, we're going to make this happen. In a very different way.
And what do you think people would choose to do that local government doesn't? I mean, I'm actually very in favour of what those kind of experiments. But what do you think people would choose to do that that people haven't been doing, or local government isn't doing?
To give you just one practical example, if you want to set up a community-owned renewable wind supply or hydro supply, at the moment there's no way of getting at-risk funding. Until you've got the planning permission, there's nowhere to get funding from. If you had that control over local budgets where you could say, okay, we're going to fund it while it's at risk and then the community can take it on, that would enable communities all around the country to jump the biggest hurdle they face.
And do you think our feed-in tariffs will help? You know, we're introducing these feed-in tariffs.
I think your feed-in tariffs will help. They're a lot too late, but thank God you're doing them.
Okay, that's a good note to end on.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
What a wonderful interview, first. Were you expecting Ed to turn up today?
Yes.
You were?
Yeah. I met Ed's speechwriter, Dominic Maxwell, a couple of weeks ago. And we were just talking generally about the relationship between government and transition, because we're really, really interested in having meaningful support, but we're worried as well, because actually government can kill things stone dead. So we talked, and the idea came up of Ed coming to the conference, and we thought that, yes, he should come, but as a keynote listener, not as a keynote speaker.
Do you think his listening interest will transition into actually supporting transition movement at a government level?
Yeah, I think if I was a government, I would be fascinated and also feel threatened by transition. I would really, really want to tap into this energy and this wanting to do something meaningful about big challenges. And I would also feel slightly scared that
this doesn't fit into the normal boxes and could be quite disruptive.
The whole idea of communities breaking away, becoming more independent, having their own currency, own energy,
if you look back at the history of really the last 200 years, what we've seen is a steady centralization of power. More and more power going to those who feel they know best. And actually what transition is about saying is that we know best for ourselves. Give us the power back. So while they might like the idea, I think the practice is going to feel threatening.
Can I ask a question? Do you think you're going to get a call from Ed's boss asking about how you do inspiring leadership?
I'd be very surprised if we did.
Okay.
We may. Never know.
Thank you.
I'll keep my phone on.
Yeah, should we give you Rob's number so Gordon can call him?